Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by none other than Blinkist. Blinkist is an app which condenses 4,000 of the best non-fiction books in the world into 15-minute summaries, or blinks, which you can read or listen to. It is perfect for those who want to cheat at their book clubs. But the way I use Blinkist is very particular. You see, when I first heard of Blinkist, it was 2016, someone sent me a link to the app. I listened to my first blink in the gym, and I decided that Blinkist was not for me. I turned my back on Blinkist because my thinking at the time was that you should never use anything as a substitute for actually reading a book. You need to understand the author's reasoning in all of its detail and nuance, and there are no shortcuts, swagmen and swagettes. But I since came to realize that I was thinking about Blinkist wrong. You see, Blinkist isn't a substitute for reading, it complements reading. It helps you decide which books to invest your time and money in. It's kind of like Amazon's look inside feature or Kindle's sample feature, except whereas those generally only let you see the introduction, Blinkist condenses the core thesis and key insights of the book. There are certain categories of books which I probably wouldn't go out and buy, but I'm still curious about. I'm wondering what all the fanfare and hurrah is about. One example recently is 1 Billion Americans by Matt Iglesias. It's kind of journalistic. It's probably not a book that I'd go out of my way to read, but I was wondering what all the fuss was about. So I listened to it on Blinkist. Another example is The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker. I generally avoid business books because they almost exclusively focus on the dependent variable, but I'd heard good things about the Effective Executive. So I listened to it on Blinkist, and that enabled me to know what I'm actually missing out on or not missing out on. And in this case, I ended up buying the Effective Executive. So to use Blinkist to help supercharge your reading abilities, go to blinkist.com/swagman, where they are offering you 25% off an annual subscription, and on top of that, you get to try Blinkist Premium free for 7 days. So go to blinkist.com/swagman.
You're listening to the Jolly Swagman podcast. Here's your host, Joe Walker.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, swagmen and swagettes, welcome back to the show. It is great to have you here. Firstly, if you're new to the show, welcome especially. Thank you for coming on board. Every week we have more swagmen and swagettes, and we welcome you to the tribe. If you are new, make sure you follow or subscribe to the show, depending on which podcast app you use. We generally release episodes every Monday morning at 6:30 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. That's Sunday evening for the Brits and Sunday afternoon for the Yanks. So make sure you do subscribe or follow to ensure that you don't miss new episodes as and when we release them. This episode was a fantastic conversation with one of my favorite people, a man who I deeply respect, a person who has real skin in the game and authenticity. He's a real person, and he has had a stunning and storied career as an economist and politician. My guest is Yiannis Varoufakis. The first time I had Yanni on the show in 2018, he came to me as a martyr. He was the former finance minister of Greece, a position he occupied from January to July 2015 when he fell on his sword and resigned from parliament. But the man I spoke with in 2020 in November was a man resurrected, returned from political exile. In February 2016, Yiannis founded the Democracy in Europe Movement 2025, DM25 for short. And in July 2019, under the new movement that he created, he was re-elected to the Greek parliament. So Yiannis is a sitting politician, and he has continued his other role, which is as a public intellectual, and particularly as a public intellectual who questions capitalism. And this conversation is indeed a conversation about capitalism, about when it works, when it doesn't, and whether and how to change it. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Without much further ado, here is Yiannis Varoufakis. Yiannis Varoufakis, welcome to the show.
It's very good to be back.
Yanni, if a society is fair, then people who work harder accumulate more. If it's free, people will give their wealth to their children. But then the society cannot be equal because some people inherit wealth that they did not earn. Given that trilemma, do you accept that we can never achieve a utopian society that is simultaneously fair, free, and equal?
No, you see, I don't believe so, because it depends on your definition of fairness, equality, and freedom. I'm not a great fan of equality, I have to tell you, even though I'm a lefty, because I have no answer to the question, equality of what? Equality of income is unfair and rather uninteresting, because, you know, if you have a disabled person and an able-bodied person, and you give them the same amount of money, that's not equality, because the handicapped person requires more money in order to achieve the same level of something, you know, a successful life. So as far as I'm concerned, my criticism of capitalism, for instance, is not that it is producing inequality, it's that it produces a lot of unhappiness, a lot of inefficiency, a lot of wasted human energy, of discontent. So I do believe that you can have equality of something that we cannot define. Therefore, let's not worry about equality, of defining equality. Fairness, well, fairness is in the eye of the beholder. But I do believe in a world where we are all free from exploitation, from need, from fear, from a sense of, you know, just living in a place, in a community, in a society, that wastes our capacity, our talents, collectively and individually.
So is that what utopia means to you? Or does utopia mean something else?
You see, I don't even believe in utopia. And the book that I wrote is not an attempt at creating a utopia. I remember an advertisement back in the early 1980s in Britain by Saatchi & Saatchi, of all people, which I found, you know, very amusing. It featured a remarkable actor at the time. You remember the protagonist from Blade Runner 1, the tall guy, you know, with the white hair. He looks like an extraterrestrial anyway. He was walking down the road and there was a bit of mist around him, and he said, "I come from Mars. On Mars, there is no exploitation, there is no oppression, there is no need, there is no hunger, there is no war. Everybody is extremely happy and equal and so on. Me? I moved to Earth." So the idea of a perfect society is repugnant to me. There is no such thing as a perfect society. But we live in a dystopia. This is my view of the world we live in. It's remarkable because we have all these capacities, we have all these technologies, we have made so much progress, and yet we are producing at an industrial scale discontent and unhappiness and depravity and despair. Look at all the people who are, you know, either on opiates or are committing suicide, amongst the rich as well, right? I mean, they all have shrinks. They all, you know, cry themselves to sleep at night if they can sleep without pills, you know. So, you know, I want a world in which we don't waste all our capacities the way we do.
Yeah, the deaths of despair is certainly a troubling trend, and I think if capitalism's core credential of steadily rising living standards is what is commonly used to justify the existence and the continuance of the capitalist system, then that credential has been tarnished in recent decades. But Yani, before we get to that, because we will discuss all of that and more, I want to start with an interesting philosophical treatise. So published in 1970, and it was Iris Murdoch's pamphlet, The Sovereignty of Good. When did you discover this and how did you react to it?
I discovered it in the 1980s because I was an avid reader of Iris Murdoch's novels. And only after I had read, you know, about 10 of her novels did I realize that she started life as a philosopher, as an academic philosopher. So out of curiosity, I thought, okay, I'll read something philosophical she's written, not novel, one of her early academic works. So I got my hands on that tiny little book called The Sovereignty of Good, which is a Neoplatonic left-wing version of Plato. And it struck me. I mean, I was always familiar with the notion from ancient Greek philosophy that a successful life is a very different thing from, you know, satisfying your desires. That, you know, cats and dogs satisfy their desires, but they're incapable of deep joy, of a seriously successful life. To be capable of that, you have to be able to do things for nothing. You know, like a wonderful artist cannot help themselves but produce art. And they're not producing art. They're not sculpting, they're not painting, they're not writing wonderful music. Beethoven did not write the Ninth in a terrible state because he was trying to make money, he was trying to become famous. He would simply die if he didn't write it. It was like something was in him that wanted to come out and, you know, just fill the world with the melodies and the rhythms. And at the time, you know, and when you do experience this moment of creativity just for the hell of it, just because you can't do otherwise, then you get a deep sense of joy. But if you try to do what you're doing to get that sense of joy, you will never get that sense of joy. So this is an ancient Greek idea, if you want, about successful life, eudaimonia, as opposed to, you know, shallow happiness. And Aris Murdoch in that Sovereignty of Good brings this out into the modern world in a beautiful way, and makes also the juxtaposition between the scientist, the true mathematician, the true physicist, and the true artist. And effectively says that they are very, very similar in the sense that a good mathematician has to overcome herself or himself in proving a fantastic theorem. At that moment, they manage to, you know, transcend, you know, their pettiness, their daily miserable concerns and so on, in the same way that an artist does. And this is her notion of good, a good that is sovereign. In other words, a good that is not to be judged on the basis of how well it achieves certain objectives. It is good because it is good on its own terms. And this seemed to me to be a fantastic way of coming to the bottom of, you know, of the meaning of life, of a successful life, of a genuinely joyous existence.
So by emancipating people from laboring in the fields and in factories, from emancipating women, especially from domestic drudgery, from giving people more disposable income and more hours with which to spend on vacation or in retirement, surely capitalism has provided a strong platform for much of the world's population to pursue those higher goods.
Well, except that it hasn't. Because if you look at women, take women, they work longer hours, especially now during the pandemic. You know, they have to look after the children. They have to do their own jobs using, you know, teleconferencing. They have to, you know, look after their, you know, less psychologically capable men. I mean, let's face it, we are the defective sex, aren't we? While you have machinery taking over lots of the chores of women, but also of workers, capitalism manages, well, the society we live in, we manage to create even more chores. And, you know, look at the interesting paradox of automation. Now, I'm all for machinery. You know, I'm a Trekkie, right? So I'd love to live in a world where, you know, there's a replicator on the wall, you can say, you know, whatever, and it comes out. From a cup of coffee to, you know, to an automobile. I want mechanical slaves. I want humanity to create slaves, mechanical slaves, so that we do not enslave ourselves. But in the world we live in, we have these magnificent machines that are being built. But at the same time, next door to a factory that is operating on its own, and that now we have factories that have almost no workers in them, and warehouses, you know, Amazon warehouses, where there are these robots running around doing stuff. And yet, next door, you have a factory where you have human beings that are robotized, human beings working like little robots. You have Deliveroo. You have Uber drivers. And when the Uber drivers are replaced by AI, then those humans will be thrown even lower down, you know, the pecking order of the labor market. They're going to be doing even more repetitive things. If you look at the Amazon warehouses, where you do have all these robots running around, the pickers who actually are now stationary and all those machines, robotized machines come to them, you know, the pickers are actually doing a robot's work. So it is not as if we have created all these machines that have liberated us. They have taken many of the tasks that we used to do, but now the tasks that the majority of humanity do are just as arduous, just as soul-crushing, just as repetitive. So as a species, we have created mechanical slaves, but we have enslaved ourselves even deeper without using the emancipatory capacity of the machines. And that's because of our politics. This is because of our failure collectively to own those machines and put them to use for the purposes of the collective, not in the interest of the very, very few who own those damn things.
I just want to take a step back for a moment. How do you define capitalism?
Oh, it's really very simple. There's nothing. By the way, let me start by how I do not define it.
Sure.
For me, capitalism is not markets. We always had markets before capitalism. We had markets during feudalism. We had markets during the slave owning era. Capitalism is a very recent invention of humanity. It's only 250 years old, no more than that. And it is based on the labor market, having people who do not own means of production, machines, land, companies, factories, shops, and the only thing they can do to survive is by selling their labor time. That is very new. You know, peasants used to work very hard under very awful conditions, like slaves before them, but they were not selling their labor. They were retaining part of their product. With capitalism, you have people who, you know, live in an apartment somewhere, a small apartment, and if they can't sell their labor time to somebody who owns a company but who doesn't work in it, usually, with this awful concentration of ownership of most companies in the hands of some anonymous people, people that you don't even know who they are when you work for the company that they own, that's capitalism. The separation of those who own but do not work and from those who work but do not own.
So that strikes me as a very Marxist definition. And the reason I wanted to draw that out was just to clarify the scope of the conversation, because I would probably have a different emphasis when I was defining capitalism. I would say that it's the combination of private property rights and then competitive markets. And that the great miracle of capitalism is decentralized decision-making subject to competition. But having said that, it doesn't work on autopilot and it does need guardrails. People are selfish, people will freeload, people will create monopolies, and certain rules and limits have to be put in place to encourage and foster cooperation and the spreading of benefits. Do we sort of agree on that?
Well, you didn't say anything that is inconsistent with my definition of capitalism. It is a Marxist definition because yeah. Marx defined capitalism. Let's face it. You wouldn't be using the word capitalism had Marx not written Das Kapital before Marx wrote Das Kapital and defined capitalism. And also, in the first few pages of the Communist Manifesto, waxed lyrical about the capacity of markets through decentralized decision-making effectively to destroy a whole network of superstition that oppressed humanity and repressed our capacity to be productive. That's all Marx. Marx said all that, you know, a century before you know, the great liberal and libertarian writers like von Hayek and Friedman and so on talked about capitalism. The problem is that when you start talking about competitive markets, the world we live in, begs to differ. We don't have competitive capitalism. We are now in a kind of post-capitalism, a techno-feudalism, Because Joey, let's face it, 90% of companies listed in the New York Stock Exchange belong to three companies. 90%. That's a very large section. Right? So to be talking about competitive capital, what competitive capitalism? When BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street own 90% of U.S. Corporations listed in the New York Stock Exchange. You have Amazon. You have Facebook. They are mini Soviet unions. Google. If you visit the wonderful campus of Google in Silicon Valley, the moment you enter Google, you exit the marketplace. There's no market in Google. Yeah, it's a centrally planned, gigantic company, where you've got a very strict hierarchy. Okay, it's a very interesting place. I'm not criticizing it. I'm simply describing the fact that is incontrovertible, that there's no market in it. It's all run on the basis of hierarchical central planning, like Gosplan, Soviet Union. It's got a much better aesthetic than the Soviet Union did. It's more efficient. But it has an aesthetic, which is the company aesthetic, the color schemes and the furniture. Well, it's all very, very nice, right? But it is not the result of decentralized decision making. Let's make no mistake here. And the thing with these companies, which is now, of course, becoming a major feature of the whole mode of production in which we live, the main feature is that they are not just monopolies. There's something much greater than that, much bigger than that, much more threatening than that. If you were Standard Oil in the 1920s that Theodore Roosevelt broke up with his antitrust legislation, that was a monopoly. Yeah, Standard Oil was monopolizing the petrol stations. That's it. But they didn't own the street. It didn't own the car. It did not own media capable of inputting into people's brains, where they wanted to drive and what they wanted to do. Whereas Facebook, once you enter Facebook, you are owned effectively. You enter an environment which is completely owned by one company. And if you step out of it, if you and I were to create software better than Facebook, no one would use it because all their friends are in Facebook. So you've got, you don't have competitive capitalism. It's been a while since we haven't had competitive capitalism, actually, since the 1920s with the networked firm. I remember John Kenneth Galbraith, the great American economist, who was given the task by Franklin Roosevelt during the Second World War, during the war economy, to fix all prices. Yeah, to just completely sidestep the market economy as in the context of the war economy and decide the price of everything. And I remember a journalist once asked him, Mr. Galbraith, that must have been a terrible, terribly difficult thing to do. How do you fix all prices? He said, you know what? I thought so too, until I realized they were already fixed by the large conglomerates.
So we are in complete agreement as to the high and rising market concentration in many industries around the world, especially in the United States, but increasingly so in countries like Australia as well, and I'm sure in Greece and the EU too. But my prescription would be that the problem is not, to paraphrase G.K. Chesterton, that we have too much capitalism, but too few capitalists, and that market concentration and monopolies are a perversion of capitalism, not an inherent feature of it.
Well, this is an empirical issue, isn't it? We cannot prove or disprove your hypothesis theoretically. We can have views about it, but it's an empirical issue. The fact of the matter is that whenever capitalism has taken hold, whether it was in Venice early in the 14th century, when there was a brief period of capitalism, which then died before it was reborn, the United States, Central Europe, China, Japan, wherever capitalism has grown roots, it has tended towards exceptionally high levels of concentration. And, I think that this is natural. And it is natural because of something that, people like Schumpeter, who's not exactly a left winger. He's one of the doyens of the libertarians. Schumpeter answered the question as to why that happens. Economies of scale and economies of scope. Think about it. The moment we moved from the first to the second industrial revolution, that is from steam to electromagnetism, the combination of electricity and magnetism that gave rise to radio, to the electricity grid, and all those wonders of technology that capitalism threw up. The moment we did that, we created Edison. Edison is a company that was, through the great innovative spirit of Thomas Edison himself, was producing everything from the electric lamp and the stove and the oven, all the way to the power generation station and the grid connecting all these things together. The moment you create such a gigantic firm, you are far away from the idea of Adam Smith, of the baker, the butcher, and the brewer. The other thing, Joe, to recognize is that the moment you have the capacity to build such a networked firm, which in our days becomes Amazon, right? The moment you have such a mega firm, vertically integrated, taking advantage of economies of scale, economies of scope, you're going to end up with a mega bank. Because the little banks back in the 1890s that existed, small banks, and they were competing against each other. Many of them were failing, and so on. And J.P. Morgan was coming and salvaging them or taking them over. None of them had the capacity to produce enough credit to fund and to finance Edison or Henry Ford. So the creation of the mega firm, which is the result of electromagnetism, gave rise to the mega bank. Small banks consolidating or taken over by J.P. Morgan or by whoever, okay, and creating a mega bank. The combination of the mega bank that can conjure up huge quantities of private money out of thin air, as you know that they do, to fund the mega corporation means the end of the competitive capitalist model of the baker, the butcher, and the brewer. So allow me to finish with a controversial statement that is not unfamiliar to you because you've read my book. For me, if you really want a competitive society, a competitive market society, a society based, a democratic, liberal, competitive market society, we need to go beyond capitalism. We need to liberate ourselves from capitalism for the separation of profits from wages, of capital from labor, in order to have the kind of competitive markets that is closer to the spirit of Adam Smith.
I just want to note one thing, and that is that I don't think that the opportunity to charge monopoly profits, at least for a short period of time, is a bad thing. In fact, it is essential to capitalism, and that was the logic of Schumpeter and indeed, more recently, Justice Scalia, which is that the ability to create a monopoly and charge those monopoly profits is what spurs would-be entrepreneurs into action in the first instance. That's not the problem. The problem is, having established the monopoly, whether they're then able to pull the ladder up behind them and ensure that no other competitors can enter their market. So that's sort of the problem that we should be addressing. Rent-seeking, cronyism, regulatory capture, rather than the existence of monopoly profits per se. But Yanni, I just want to pause for a moment and check whether, the various problems that you have with capitalism have come out in a piecemeal fashion so far. So I just wanted to stop and ask you whether there was anything that we haven't mentioned yet as far as the concerns you have with capitalism.
Well, my main concern with capitalism is humanistic. It's got to do with the fact that I think that, speaking as a liberal, capitalism is illiberal. It creates, through a process of mechanizing production, which I want, right, and I applaud. Nevertheless, this mechanization, in a sense, embeds humanity to the machine rather than turning the machine into a human liberator. So you end up with a situation where both employers and employees start resembling guinea pigs on a treadmill. The faster they go, the more exhausted they are, the more angst-ridden they are, but they are not getting anywhere. In the end, they are actually going backwards. And, you mentioned Schumpeter. If you read his magnum opus, you'll find that he himself, who is a great supporter of the idea of innovation through monopoly profits and so on, he ends up being exceptionally pessimistic about the end of all this. He starts saying that in the end, we're going to end up with monopoly capitalism, with deep dissatisfaction everywhere, with the end of democracy. He has a very dystopic view of how this whole thing is panning out. So that is my criticism of capitalism. My criticism of capitalism is that it does, in the interests of emancipation, of freeing us up, of competition and so on, it leads to wholesale discontent, to lack of competition, to lack of cooperation, and in the end, to the poisoning of our democracies.
That's where I think we part ways, because I'm not sure that those things are inherent to capitalism, even as I completely agree with you that they're huge problems that need to be fixed. But I would say that we need more capitalism, not post-capitalism. I think that's where we differ. But I just want to...
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
I have no doubt that we are in agreement that we need more competition and better markets, and sometimes I would even agree more markets. But can we also agree that this is not the same thing as more capitalism? Markets are not capitalism. Let's try to separate the two. Let me put it this way. One of the best way of explaining to students in economics departments the functioning of markets is to bring up a fantastic article written by a chap called Radford in 1945, who had spent a couple of years in a concentration camp, in a prisoners of war camp in Germany, as a British pilot, I believe, in which he explains how a market emerged inside the POW camp as a result of the Red Cross parcels that prisoners would get, that had a little bit of tea, a little bit of coffee, some chocolate, a bit of that and so on, how an exchange economy emerged where, the Frenchmen would sell their tea to the, give their tea to their British friends in exchange for coffee and so on and so forth. And it's a magnificent explanation of the beauty of markets and how, efficient they can be. But there's no capitalism in there because there's no production, no distinction between profit and labor, okay? And there's no money market. The moment you throw into a well-functioning marketplace a labor market, a distinction between employer and employee, wages and prices, and you weaponize this by bringing in a mega bank that has the capacity to conjure up huge quantities of private money by which to create a nexus between ownership, share ownership, and private money minting. At that moment, you are destroying the capacity of competitive markets to be competitive and to actually produce good for society. That is my view. This is why I'm saying that if you really want more efficiency, more markets, and greater space for innovative people to do good stuff that benefit others, then we need to go beyond capitalism.
Yeah, see, I still think that you're arguing against a definition of capitalism that I don't share. And maybe let's approach it this way. So I feel like your critique risks coming across as overly rhetorical. So you talk about workers becoming like robots, but someone could come along with a different interpretation and look at the situation of labor and profit and say, well, what a wonderful thing, you know, consenting adults who are free to choose where they work in a free market can then offer their labor in exchange for a wage and live very happy and fulfilling careers working in firms where they have autonomy and meaning. I mean, why couldn't we just apply a different lens?
This whole thing collapses once you take them to look at an Amazon warehouse. You take them around to, you know, you show them how people live, young people in particular, in the precariat, working for Uber, working for Deliveroo, and to, you know, say that these people are choosing that kind of career, in inverted commas, which is absolutely dead end, you know, these bullshit jobs that keep proliferating, and to, you know, portray them as a manifestation of human freedom and creativity, is simply, you know, being Panglossian and assuming, just because it suits you, that we live in the best of all possible worlds.
Sure. So let's talk about those workers and unskilled labor, manufacturing labor, the kind of workers who work in the Amazon warehouses, workers who don't have college education, who for the last few decades have sort of been abandoned and left behind by Western capitalism. So before 1970, we can both agree economic growth was relatively rapid and its fruits were relatively equally distributed. But after 1970, it was as if we had two escalators, to use an analogy of Angus Deaton and Anne Case's. So one escalator for the well-educated and already well-off started moving faster, and then the other escalator for those without a college degree and who were less well off started stalling or even moving downwards. And I think that the divergence between wages growth for people with college education and people without college education is in large part underpinned by the stagnation we've found ourselves in since the 70s, whereby if the overall pie isn't growing, then, you know, like the rising tide isn't lifting all boats, to use two analogies in the same sentence. But secondly, a growth in rent seeking, because if the overall pie isn't growing, then people turn from positive sum innovation to zero sum thinking, where it's about trying to create moats and steal from other groups in society and fight over the scraps. So to me, the plight of those people you identified, the people that you want to characterize as the robots working in, you know, David Graeber's bullshit jobs, that is ultimately traceable to the very problems that are assailing capitalism that I've been pointing to, namely rent seeking.
Allow me to answer in two steps. Okay.
Please.
Step number one, let's try to get to the bottom of it. What is it that changed since the mid-1970s? Because you're quite right. There's been a structural discontinuity shift around 1973, 1975. What caused it? It's not that people became more rent-seeking than they were before. It's not that, you know, human nature was somehow altered. No. What happened was the end of Bretton Woods. Now, Bretton Woods was a 20, 25-year period, the first post-war period, that was effectively a global plan. It was globally designed and centrally planned. You had a fixed exchange rate regime. Effectively, the whole of the West was dollarized. The dollar was the anchor. Forget gold. The dollar was the anchor. And you had fixed exchange rates. Simultaneously, you had capital controls. In other words, the financial genie was placed very firmly in the bottle and the lid was shut very tightly. So if you were a banker, there was very little you could do. It was only bread and butter, plain vanilla banking, which is a great thing, I believe. And you had more or less free trade, or quite free-ish trade, compared to the previous era, at least. And you had a constant recycling of American surpluses to Europe and to Japan in order to underpin the system. Because the one thing that the dealer, the new dealers who created Bretton Woods understood well was that if you simply fix exchange rates, you'll end up to the 1920s and then you'll have a crash like 1929. So to maintain fixed exchange rates, you need constantly to take surpluses from where they are and shift them to the deficit regions. A recycling mechanism is necessary, in other words, to underpin a common monetary system. That was Bretton Woods. Whose surplus was being recycled? The American surplus. America was the only serious creditor and surplus country coming out of the Second World War. The Marshall Aid Plan, the way in which America constantly subsidized Japanese industry, the two pillars, in other words, Europe with Germany at its heart and Japan on the other hand, underpinning the dollarized Bretton Woods system. That system could only die, even though it was exceptionally successful. It was a golden era of capitalism. You had the shrinking inequality. You had very low inflation, very low unemployment, you know, steady growth. But that system had to die because it was predicated on American surpluses. Once the American surpluses disappeared, for reasons I'm not going to get into now, by the late 1960s, Bretton Woods was always going to die. And it died. And what did the American authorities do? In the early 1970s, including people like Paul Volcker, the U.S. Treasury Secretary at the time, John Connolly, unlike the Germans, yeah, if the Germans go into a deficit, they tighten their belt, right? And maybe in Australia too. But, you know, the Americans, when they go into the deficit, they hit the accelerator. They say, okay, we have a deficit, we're going to maximize it. And that's exactly what they did. They boosted, beyond belief, the trade deficit of the United States. And they destroyed the system they had created. Because I'm forever, you know, delighted by the radical thinking that goes on in Washington. They create huge global systems and then they jettison them the moment they realize that they're past their due date. So they did that. They hit the accelerator and they said, okay, now the rest of the world will pay for our deficit. And how did that work? Well, the American deficit was a huge vacuum cleaner that was sucking into the United States the net exports of the increasing monopolies of Japan, of Germany, of course, and later China. Right? And how was the deficit paid for? By creating the circumstances in Wall Street so that the profits accumulating in the coffers of the Germans, the Japanese, the Chinese, the Saudis, the Dutch, the Italians, and so on, you know, found them their way voluntarily to Wall Street because Wall Street was giving them higher returns. How was Wall Street giving higher returns? By creating slightly less inflation in the United States compared to Japan and Europe at the time during those inflationary era, and by suppressing American wage growth below German and Japanese wage growth. So effectively, you know, those who voted for Trump in 2016, the left behind, the, you know, the Rust Belt folks and so on, well, their origins can be found in the 1970s suppression of wages, which killed off the American dream that, you know, my kids are going to have a better living standard than me. So this is the process we've been following. Now, in the context of this financialization, right? Because when you have a tsunami of capital going from Europe and Asia to Wall Street, you give a few billion dollars to a financier in Wall Street for 5 minutes. They find ways of making it, you know, divide and multiply. This is called derivatives, financialization. This is why financialization took off in the late 1970s. And that has to have an ideology that goes with it. It's called neoliberalism. I don't think that neoliberalism has anything to do with liberalism, and it's not particularly new. It was a set of propaganda that was necessary to not justify the unshackling of the bankers from all the constraints of the Bretton Woods and the New Deal era. So this is, I think, what happened. And the rent-seeking going, you know, rising exponentially, going through the stratosphere that you described, and I agree with your description, is to be found in that systemic process that took us from the first post-war era to the second post-war, which crashed and burned in 2008 with the collapse of financialization. So that's step one of my response. The step two, I promise, is going to be much shorter. Much shorter. And it's got to do, you talked about the two escalators. One going down for the working class, especially in the Rust Belts, one going up for college educated and so on. But even there, Joe, I despair at what happens to the people who are on the upward escalator. I don't believe that those who were, okay, of course, they had a lot more money, they drove Porsches, they had, the lifestyle of the 1980s, awful and aesthetically displeasing as it was, but nevertheless, you know, they popped the champagne bottles open and they had all that. But that was not a good life either. It was not what I call a successful life. It was not a joyous life. If you think that financialization wasted so much human talent, you know, wonderful young men and women from Stanford University, from MIT, who studied theoretical physics and mathematics, very clever people. They ended up working for Lehman Brothers and Goldman Sachs, doing what? Nothing of value to anyone, creating exceptionally complicated forms of debt in the form of derivatives as part of this financialization. Okay. I mean, when you look inside the mathematics of these financial derivatives, they're wonderful, they're brilliant. But what a waste of human resources. Instead of doing something good, you know, discovering the new green technology that will, you know, produce fusion, I don't know, whatever. They were working for bloody Goldman Sachs. To do what? To disguise a very risky debt as riskless. So my criticism is not, you know, an us against them, you know, labor versus capital, the left behinds versus those who did fantastically well. I don't think that they did fantastically well. I think that those who were on the upward escalator were even more, you know, destroyed souls than the ones that were left behind and ended up voting for Trump.
Yeah, I think Larry Summers once did looked at the correlation between the ratio of engineers to lawyers in a country and its economic growth rate, and it was not favorable towards the legal profession. But yeah, I agree. There are too many. There's like an overabundance of people going into those non-value creating professions like law and finance. But this is speculative on my part, but I view that as a distant symptom of the deeper technological stagnation in which we find ourselves. The idea that from the end of the second industrial revolution in 1870, 1890, through to the 1970s, we picked the low-hanging fruit of technology. Many things which, you know, could only be done once, like, you know, air travel, flushing toilets, frozen food, domestic appliances, the automobile, radio was introduced, which was quickly superseded by television, which was then supplanted by color television. Infant mortality rates plummeted. We had vaccines and medicines, like all these amazing technologies, which were perhaps historically contingent. Like, there's no reason why technological progress should be even throughout history. It's likely to be sort of bunched. And perhaps we're just going through a period now where, the adjacent possibilities, the next innovations are just hard. Ideas are getting harder to find until we discover the next orchard and have a revolution in whatever the next big thing is. But with growth and productivity growth stagnating since the 1970s, that's when, instead of going into value-creating industries, that's when you go and become a lawyer, or you go into finance, you become an investment banker, because you're just trying to sort of protect what little scraps you can get in a society that's not increasing the size of the overall pie as much as it once was.
Look, granted that innovation, technological progress is lumpy. It's not linear. It's lumpy. It always was, always will be. That is not the issue. It is not the reason why we're wasting human energy and talent. We're wasting human energy and talent because of the concentration of ownership of the means of production. In other words, capitalism. I will go back to that. Let me give you a very simple example, right? I remember it was a life-changing experience. Some years ago, I was in Texas, near Austin, where I was taken to see the construction site of Apple's first factory in the United States for decades. They were, you know, planning to bring back home from China a manufacturing facility where, you know, laptops like mine were going to be made. And it was life-changing because it was a very large site. It ended up becoming a huge factory where the MacBook Pro was being built and is being built, right? And it was life-changing because this huge construction site had six human beings on site. They were all sitting around a table with joysticks and computers, and the rest was being done mechanically. And it was wonderful to watch these trucks, excavators, cable-laying machinery working automatically without a single human being touching them, except for those, you know, engineers, computer scientists, I don't know what they were, sitting around that table, okay? And they very proudly explained to me that this is going to be completed in 6 months, and, you know, the laptops will start coming out, and there will be no human workers involved in the production of those laptops. It will be all automated. So machines building the factory, and more machines within the factory will build the laptops. And then the question is, who is going to buy the bloody laptops? Because the robots are not going to buy them. Okay? Now, if this was a facility that was collectively owned, you know, then we would all share the laptops. And the laptops would then, you know, increase our productivity. We would do great things with that. We would then, you know, conceivably innovate more individually. But when, you know, you have such high concentration of ownership of that machinery, of the machines, building machines that will build the laptops, you have a serious macroeconomic failure. You have very low levels of demand. So what Apple is going to do, recognizing that you know, demand out there is very low because, you know, workers out there are not being employed by Apple to produce the Apple MacBooks. Okay. So what do you do as a monopolist of Apple MacBooks, you know, when you have a customer base that is financially constrained? You push the price up. You push the price up by reducing investment in production. So you've got fewer jobs, and you have higher prices than you would have had otherwise, because this is, you know, textbook economics 101. I mean, it's not a question of that is controversial, right? So you end up with low levels of demand, and therefore lower innovation, both by human beings that don't have in the end access to the best laptops that they could have because the machines could have produced them, if ownership was not so heavily concentrated. So it's not that the human mind at some point, you know, needs a break before it comes up with the next best idea. It is our capitalist foundations that are generating low levels of investment into the machinery that we can produce and into the good quality jobs that can produce the incomes that would generate the creation of those machines. So the mystery of creativity is something beyond us. So yes, yeah, maybe there will be periods of, you know, as you said, low-hanging fruit, higher-hanging fruit, and so on and so forth. But the problem we now face is that we have a system that generates low levels of investment when we have the highest level of liquidity and savings. This is a gross systemic failure, which explains anything from illiberal politics, you know, Trumpism on the one hand, to all the way to the failures of our schooling system, the failures of our public health systems, the failures of society to deal with COVID-19 and so on and so forth.
So we live in a tragedy. I think that much is now clear, but let me just say, Yanni, let me just say one nice, and a comedy, yeah, and a farce. Let me just say one nice thing. I feel like I've become capitalism's inadvertent staunchest defender in this conversation, but let me just say one nice thing about capitalism, because I don't necessarily agree with your characterization that everyone's kind of living miserable lives, including people on high incomes, like the people with college degrees who've gone on the escalator upwards and more quickly. I think if you actually look at, I mean, this is an empirical question, and if you actually look at the literature on happiness, it's pretty clear, and it comes out in favor of capitalism, or at least of the benefits of economic growth. So, for example, the most comprehensive study of the income-happiness link so far is Betsy Stevenson and Justin Wolfer's study, which found that the relationship between measured well-being and income is roughly log linear, which implies that income boosts happiness even at higher levels of earnings. And that was roughly corroborated by a study by Angus Deaton, which found similar results, namely that extra income brings extra happiness, even in relatively wealthy settings. Then we also have literature on broader, more sort of transcendental questions. For example, Ben Friedman's book, The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth, which shows that many of the virtues of the modern world and our ability to live, live out that ancient Greek ideal of eudaimonia depend not only on higher, but on increasing levels of growth. And that we have been able to achieve that thanks to capitalism. So the question of are we happier is an empirical question, and it would seem to come out in favor of the capitalist system, at least so far.
You remind me of a school teacher of mine who had this jejune belief that the better our school performance as kids, the higher the chance we would get rich. And he was chastising a friend of mine who was sitting next to me for not paying attention. And my friend decided he was going to become recalcitrant and say to the teacher, "Yeah, but you know, money can't buy me happiness." And the teacher said, "Yeah, I agree with you. But it's better to be depressed in a Ferrari than in a bus." This is what you remind me of. Now, look, this literature on happiness, I have a liberal disposition. I believe that anybody should research anything they want. But it really leaves me completely stone cold. Any attempt to measure happiness is self-defeating. And in the end, when you try to quantify such a qualitative, magnitude, then you end up, you end up confirming any hypothesis empirically that you care for. Allow me to say that in the same context that some researchers are trying to prove that, capitalism has produced in the end more wealth, and more wealth has produced more happiness. Since you are in Australia, let me tell you that from where I'm standing, the greatest amount of happiness on that continent pre-existed capitalism, indeed pre-existing the invasion of the whites. The Aborigines, according to anthropologists, had a perfectly happy life. They worked very, very little. They didn't have hunger issues. They did not have alcoholism issues. They had no money, but they were far happier than they have been since the whites brought their wonderful capitalist machinery along with them, beginning at Botany Bay. Now, the fact that we can now measure incomes and find some correlation between, let's say, the propensity of an Aborigine to commit suicide and how much money they now have, simply does not disprove the fact that capitalism has visited a catastrophe upon people like the Aborigines, something that no econometric study measuring happiness can ever come to terms with. Having said all that, I'm not a degrowth person. I'm not one of those people who say, "Oh, now we need to go back to the bush and we need to reduce growth." Whenever I hear my friends and comrades and colleagues from the left side of politics go on and on about degrowth, I lose the will to live. I say to them, growth of what? You know, there are things I want to see shrink to nothing. Yeah. Derivatives. Yeah, it would be good if we had no derivatives. They serve no purpose for humanity whatsoever except do damage. I want to see CO2 emissions go to zero. I want degrowth of that. I want degrowth of SUVs. I personally dislike SUVs. I'm a motorcyclist. I hate SUVs. You know, the fewer SUVs we have, the better. I want to see a reduction in the amount of concrete that we use in building materials, right? But I want to see better art. I want to see more art. I want to see more, theaters. I want to see, great movies, more Star Trek episodes. I want a serious growth in that. I want to see growth in the care sector, in health, in education. So the question is not whether we should have growth or not. What should grow and what should shrink? The problem with these crude econometric exercises for the purposes of confirming a Panglossian view that in the end, we have the best system that we could possibly have, warts and all. It leaves me cold, as I said.
Yeah, happiness is a slippery concept. And for that very same reason, the reason you identified, we could actually be underestimating how happy growth has made people in the West. Because when you use that word happiness and you ask people in third world countries or developing countries whether they're happy, it's a very ambiguous word. And so in a lot of the surveys, people might actually adjust what they think of as happiness given their squalid and miserable conditions often in many cases. And so they're actually overstating how happy they are because they've adapted. And so in other words, we're actually understating how happy people with high incomes are in many Western nations. But I do agree, money is not everything. It can to an extent buy happiness. But happiness is kind of one of those weird and conglomerate or compound concepts that involves a lot of different ideas. And the term you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, eudaimonia, is sort of supposed to capture all of that, the human flourishing as well as the momentary pleasure. But it seems that the flourishing, the meaning, the satisfaction people draw from their lives is something that is not the same as money, but having a good job can create a sense of meaning and structure in one's life. And I suppose that is what underpins the deaths of despair that we see both in Indigenous communities in Australia and also in the white working class in the United States. Yani, a couple of months ago, we all celebrated the 50th anniversary of Milton Friedman's article, which was published in the New York Times magazine, arguing that the social responsibility of a business is to increase its profits. What has been the impact of this doctrine?
Window dressing of what was going on anyway. You see, we academics and intellectuals have a tendency to overestimate the importance of the output of intellectuals and academics. We're not as important as we think. What was going on was going on anyway, despite of Friedman. Or indeed, in 1936, when John Maynard Keynes published his general theory that, we of the left of center wax more lyrical about compared to Friedman's article, we think that it was more important than it really was. The reason why you talk about Friedman today is because the end of Bretton Woods precipitated the new phase of financialization and effectively unshackling the bankers from the New Deal's restraints. That was happening even if Friedman had not written the article, if he had never been born, it was going to be happening. So my view of history is that, there are big tectonic shifts, they happen, and once they happen, and there's a real break from what was going on before, some kind of theorist, some kind of article, some kind of book becomes, if you want, the ideological manifestation mantra of the shift that was happening in any case. And we tend to have a tendency to say, it was this book that changed the world. No, the world changed and the world required some texts in order to explain itself. So Friedman's book was exactly like that, in the same way Keynes's book did for the transition after 1929, that which Friedman's and Hayek's treatises did for the coming of financialization, providing the ideological cover.
We've spoken about the singular disaster for Homo sapiens that is capitalism, and the logical question that probably, of course being partly facetious, but the logical question that probably springs to many people's minds is, well, what's Yanis's alternative? And that's why you wrote this book, Another Now. And the key kind of plank, the key policy prescription is this notion of one person, one share, one vote. That's sort of what a lot of the change that you're proposing springs from. So just tell me about that idea and how it would work in practice. Take as long as you need.
Well, first, I need to correct your prologue to this question. I would never, ever describe capitalism as a singular disaster to befall humanity.
Sorry, I was being cheeky.
I know. But I need to make this clear.
But we should clarify, sure.
We have a great debt of gratitude as humanity to capitalism. Capitalism liberated us from feudalism. We must not forget that. It liberated us from superstition. It freed humanity and enabled us to create material conditions that are infinitely better than they were, you know, before capitalism. There's no doubt about that. Where I'm coming from is a capacity to say that something that is freeing me and is providing me with material resources that I really need can simultaneously enslave me, can simultaneously deprive me. The same production line, think of capitalism as a production line, produces fantastic knowledge, opportunity, material goods, wealth, and new forms of illiberty, new forms of depravity, new forms of discontent. There is no contradiction in that. The contradiction comes from capitalism itself, where I'm standing from. And I want to preserve all the wonderful things that capitalism gave us in an era where capitalism is overthrowing itself, is undermining itself. It's becoming a kind of post-capitalism. If you think about it, Joe, I mean, the fact that financial markets are doing so fantastically well at a time when capitalism has tanked due to COVID-19 following 12 years of secular stagnation, as Larry Summers put it, that shows that we are no longer in something that can be described as capitalism. We are in a kind of feudalism with, you know, apps and technology and artificial intelligence coming along. So I would like us to try to find common ground, not just me and you, but, you know, people who are genuinely liberal, that we are moving into post-capitalism anyway as we speak. Can we please move into a post-capitalism which is liberal and which is, you know, worthwhile fighting for, as opposed to a kind of advanced postmodern feudalism that even does away with a great energy that capitalism through competition and competitive markets and the baker, the butcher and the brewer, Adam Smith's iconic producers, gave us. So that is a question that I try to answer in the book. How can we preserve competitive markets, or actually not preserve them, reignite them, you know, re-empower them, put them press them into action on behalf of humanity, while democratizing life more, creating more freedom for more people? That is the question, and I think that is a question that can be the basis of an understanding between people on the left, people on the right, people who consider themselves more liberal, more Marxist, more whatever, and especially facing climate change. So in this book, I try to answer the question, okay, if you don't like capitalism, or if you think capitalism is producing this dystopia, what is the alternative? And allow me to say that there are three planks. You mentioned one. In the answers I give, I try to do it in the context of a novel, which uses tools of science fiction, so as to allow me firstly, not to get bored while writing it, and secondly, to do that which a liberal should do. A liberal should always have doubt about that which he says or she says. So the way I express doubt is by creating characters. One is a neoliberal or, you know, libertarian, you can call Eva whatever you want, the other one is a feminist Marxist, the other is a technologist, and having them having debates amongst themselves so that I can express different views that I have with which I'm not, you know, necessarily in agreement or for which I feel very, very, very much on fragile ground. So this is the format of the book. But the three planks of the other now, of, you know, a market based socialism that is also democratic and liberal, they are the following. First, you mentioned it. Imagine that the moment you get hired by a company, a corporation, a small, medium-sized firm, you get one share. And in the same way that when you enroll at college or university, you get a library card. It does give you rights to do stuff like borrow books, use the computer facilities, you know, sporting facilities, vote in elections for the students' union, for whatever, attend classes, but you can't rent it and you can't sell it. And then when you move on, you know, you go to you get another ID working for some other company. But it is a non-tradable share. And imagine that all the inequalities of pay within that corporation, which you need in order to reflect the fact that some people are making a greater contribution than others, are more productive, they're more innovative, and so on. But all those, you know, inequalities are consented to. They're, you know, people vote in favor of that because if they are self-interested, they will want to pay more money to somebody that adds more value to the company. Otherwise, they will lose them in a liberal, democratic market social society where people don't have to stay in a company. They can just move out, take their own capital, and create something else, a new company, a competitor. So competitive markets are embedded in my other now, except that there are no share markets. There is a market for money. You can borrow, you can lend. There is a market for everything, including land. I have what some people would consider a highly liberal or even neoliberal permanent auction system for land where you know, anyone can outbid you for the house you are occupying if they're prepared to, you know, to name a price higher than yours, and your land tax is determined by your own assessment, your own bid of the land that you're occupying. Then suddenly you have an incentive, a built-in incentive, to reveal your true valuation of the land that you're occupying. So market, it's, you know, my other now is utterly market-based, except you don't have ownership, monopoly over land, and you do not have the capacity to trade shares in the companies in which you work. And you don't have the capacity to buy shares in companies in which you don't work. That's how you destroy the difference. You annul the difference between profits and wages. Everybody's receiving a part of the revenues of the firm, and we all decide together how much will go to R&D, what it will be the minimum wage for all of us, from janitor to computer to your software engineer, what kind of bonus system we have, how we allocate brownie points in order for bonuses to be distributed. So that, you know, that's one plank. The second plank, in the other now, is cutting out the middleman in the money markets, the middleman being commercial banks. At the moment, you have central banks printing huge quantities of money, giving it to commercial banks, that then give it to conglomerates, which then buy back their own shares and not invest any of the money that comes from the central bank. That is a catastrophe, in my view. And that's not capitalism, that is statism, what we have. Right? The way money printed by the state are being usurped by the very, very, very few. This is not capitalism. I think we can agree on that. So cut out the commercial bank. Imagine that the Reserve Bank of Australia, the Fed, the European Central Bank, opens a digital account, bank account, for each resident, free. So why would you then need to open an account with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia or, you know, NAB or whoever? Banks can operate if they can find some reason, some raison d'etre, they can, if they can find services to offer you and me, sure, we can actually go to them. I'm not banning them. But if the central bank gives us a free digital bank account, and also, you know, the money that they print, instead of giving to the commercial banks, they give a universal basic dividend to everyone. And that can go up and down depending on the economic cycle. That's a much better way of managing the macroeconomy than the way they are doing it now through quantitative easing. And imagine a situation where, you know, $100,000, $200,000 Australian dollars is given, is put, set aside for every born, for every newborn, for every baby that is born, along with your birth certificate. When you're born, you get, you know, a trust fund with the central bank. You can't touch it for, I don't know, 20 years, but then you can submit a business plan or an education plan in the same way, you know, we academics in universities used to, or still do, submit research proposals, and we get money from, you know, the Arts Council, from a Science Research Council, and so on. So this is the second plank. Do away with the financial sector while having, you know, totally open ledger by which we can transact utterly freely and costlessly, digitally. And the third plank is about international payments, because this is important. The current system we have of international payments is creating crisis. Because, let's face it, some countries are in perpetual deficit, trade deficit, and some countries are in perpetual trade surplus. Germany has always been in trade surplus. China is in a trade surplus. Australia has a trade deficit. Greece has a trade deficit. And what happens with the present capitalist system, let's still call it that, is that during periods of growth, deficits get greater, surpluses get greater. And then when there's a slump, the burden of adjustment falls disproportionately on the deficit countries, and therefore investment falls faster in the deficit countries than in the surplus countries. And that means what? That during the growth period, the capacity of the deficit countries to grow is constrained relative to the surplus countries, so those imbalances grow further. In other words, the international payment system we have magnifies the probability of a crisis and the magnitude of a crisis and the frequency of a crisis. So in the book, I describe an alternative international payment system where, we have free trade, we have free floating exchange rates. Again, so you see, I preserve markets fully, but I try to empower them through institutional tweaks in order to reduce the capacity of the whole system to generate crisis. How? Imagine if there is a common currency unit internationally. We could use the SDRs, the special drawing rights of the IMF, which already exist. We can call them something nicer. In the book, I call them the Cosmos unit. This is never printed, so we're not creating a new international currency. An accounting unit, a digital accounting unit. That Cosmos unit has a free floating exchange rate with the Australian dollar, the American dollar, the yen, the renminbi, the euro, and so on and so forth. So far, nothing changes. It's an accounting exercise. But imagine if we said that all trade and all international payments are denominated in Cosmos units, and during a period, let's say, one financial year, any country that has a trade surplus gets taxed some of those Cosmos units, goes into a global equity account. Similarly and symmetrically, surplus countries have their surpluses taxed, it goes into the same account. Immediately that creates market dynamics, you know, influences on the exchange rates that limit both the deficits and the surpluses. So you rebalance the economy and you end up with a kitty of money, of Cosmos units, that you can then use to invest in green jobs and green technologies, especially in the deficit or developing countries.
I want to press you on the first plank of this new system, Yanni. And the way you apportion income for a company is quite interesting. So it's sliced up five ways. 5% of revenues are given over to the government. And then of the remaining income, there are four different portions. One is for research and development. The other is for the company's fixed costs. The third portion is for salaries, which are all equal. And then the final portion goes to bonuses. And the way bonuses are determined is democratically. So every employee at the company votes or sends up to 100 credits, for example, to whoever they think is most deserving of their credits. And then whoever gets you know, X percent of the credits then gets X percent of the bonus pool, and the bonus pool is decided by the employees as well. But when I was thinking about this system, the first thought that occurred to me was that in a largish firm, no one really knows what the others do. Like if you take a tech startup, the people in the sales team are probably only vaguely familiar of what the software engineers are working on. And, you know, my opinion of who's most important to the firm is probably colored by availability bias. And so in order to get the bonuses they deserve, the most productive employees who may have very esoteric skill sets will have to sort of campaign to increase the average opinion of their contribution, hampering their own productivity. Now, I imagine your answer to that problem would just be to say, well, the firms that aren't great at recognizing the most important talents are the firms that will suffer. And so through the competitive system, that will sort of work itself out. Employees can split off and create firms that are better able to recognize talent. Is that the response you would give?
It's one of three responses I would give. It is an important one. But there are two other ones. The second one is that there will be a tendency for the average size of companies to come down because the optimal size is going to be much smaller, which is good for competition, for creating more competition in markets. That's the second plank. The third plank is, you know, there's no perfect system. There, you know, it's a question of pros and cons. The alternative to what I'm proposing is the current situation where you've got strict hierarchies. You know, you get hired to do a particular job, you go into a particular box, you're in there. If you've been hired to do something else, you're stuck there. And there are compartments separating one part to the other. And there's always, you know, a hierarchy, somebody who's on top of you in your own department who has a vested interest to maintain this compartmentalization, because that's how he maintains his authority, yeah, his top dog position within his department. And a lot of talent is wasted this way. I experienced this kind of free-flowing horizontal management system in a company that I used to work for, and I've seen the benefits of the free-for-all. Of saying, okay, you were employed as a secretary, but if you actually produce good code, you become a coder immediately, and nobody has to give you permission to do it. Just do it, and let's see the result. You unleash enormous talent that way, because you know we have a tendency in our societies to think that our past is a better predictor of what we can do in the future than it really is. What university degrees do you have? What is your track record? That's all important. But, you know, people can actually do a lot more and more efficiently than they think they do. The past is a great conservative force for predicting the way in which people can actually flourish in a company that allows them to try their hand at different things. And also, you know, if the computer software engineer needs to, you say canvassing, it's more than that. You know, if you're a secretary and you know you can vote, you can give brownie points to computer software engineers, yeah, you may find ways, or you may have an incentive in the cafeteria through the internet to go and say to them, you know, what is it that you've been working on? Right? You know, this is an important question to ask in a company, for people to actually talk to one another, not say, look, I am an expert in this. You've got nothing to do with that. You don't contribute anything to my bonuses. If you know that everybody's contributing to your bonuses, it's not a bad thing to explain what you're doing. You know, as a academic teacher, I found out that if I've learned anything about anything, it's because I try to explain it to students. It's only when you try to explain that which you think you know that you realize you don't know it as well as you thought you did. And that can be, you know, very liberating and can be and productivity enhancing as well.
Is big business and unalloyed bad? Like, don't sometimes we need big companies and even mega banks in order to get big missions done?
Mega banks we don't need. They are catastrophic. They have nothing good to offer except exorbitant power that saps the energy of everybody else. Big businesses, yes. Big businesses have produced remarkable stuff. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, they are also, I don't need to explain this to you, you are a free marketeer. When you have a large company that acquires as a result of success, and as a result, take Apple. I mean, they produced magnificent gadgets, right? iPhones are wonderful machines. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, once they have this monopoly power, they can buy out thousands of startups just to shut them down and, you know, put their patents on hold, on the shelf. I have, you know, Costa, a character in my book, is a real person, at least to some extent, right? And then I just changed him completely, but he's based on a real character who, a great innovator, a great technologist. He was livid one day when he came to me and he said, "No, I have created this gadget. I'm not going to say more about it, but this gadget that could really change the life of children, that are hard of hearing. They could really, improve their cochlear implants substantially. And the company that I work for has put this new innovation, this update, in a vault because it doesn't fit with their tactics for keeping competitors at bay. So these uncompetitive monopolistic practices destroy a lot of value and a lot of innovation."
I would agree with that. Just for the record, I probably wouldn't characterize myself as a free marketeer, but I've no doubt given that impression playing devil's advocate during this conversation. Yanni, final question. In seeking to change the capitalist system, what is the way to do it? Is it through revolution or is it through moderation and incrementalism?
Both. Incremental change is important. We need to make it every day. We need to make improvements, whatever we do. But business as usual is not going to deal with the catastrophic events around the corner. Incrementalism is not going to help us overcome climate change. It is not going to help us overcome the degree of depravity and exclusion and poverty, which is reinforcing the xenophobic, ultra-right-wing, racist politicians that are taking over left, right, and center. I don't believe in violence, but I do believe in radical change. And let's face it, radical change has been very good for humanity. The collapse of the Soviet Union was, I'm saying this as a leftist, was an excellent thing. And it took a revolution. Thankfully, not much blood was spilled during those revolutions, especially in places like Czechoslovakia and so on, in the late 1980s, early 1990s. But we do need a radical change that is non-violent and which goes against, that will upset, nevertheless, very powerful people.
Yanis Varoufakis, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thanks, Joe. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. For links and notes covering everything Yanis and I discussed, please head to my website, josephnoelwalker.com. That's my full name, josephnoelwalker.com. The audio engineer for the Jolly Swagman podcast is Lawrence Moorfield. Our very thirsty and parched video editor is Alf Eddy. I'm Joe Walker. Until next week, thank you for listening. Ciao.